Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your host, Chris Seveny, and today we just finished recording with Matt Four with Next Level Income, and Matt also hosts the Ice Cream with Investors podcast, which I highly recommend you check out. Matt comes from a background of 15 years in sales leadership roles for a large tech company, and he's out of Nashville, and where he lives with his partner and two kids. Matt is very passionate about everything in life and what he does. And Matt has been heavily involved in active and passive commercial real estate over the last 10 years. And today we had a great episode where we talked about commercial landscape structure. What's it like to be a passive investor? What's it like to be a general partner and an active investor in the space? Some of the things to look for as part of the investments. And towards the end, we really started talking about, you know, real estate in general and the risk involved in real estate. And when you're investing in real estate, you have to recognize, you know, there's going to be a percentage of deals that don't turn out the way you want. And lately, because there's been an uptick in the number of those deals, you know, a lot of people have started talking about fraud or Ponzi schemes. And we kind of just want to shed light where that's rarely the case. A lot of times it's just been, it's a bad deal or sponsors inexperienced and may not have handled things the best way, but it always doesn't mean if somebody pauses distributions that it's an awful thing. There's certain assets where that's done by smart general partners in order to make sure that they're protecting their investors' equity. So talk about that. We talk about the markets. We talk about what to expect in 2025. So I highly recommend you guys check it out. And as I introduce Matt on this episode, I hope you enjoy. Welcome back, Matt, to the show. I believe you are a podcast guest back in the day when Jamie Bateman and I were doing Good Deeds Note Investing podcast. How you been?
Yeah, it's been a long time, but fantastic. A little chilly. We were talking about that. It's We're recording this right before the Christmas time here. It's a little chilly here in Nashville, but all is well. Yeah.
Yes, and I'm dressed more casual today because, yes, it's the Friday before the holiday week and, you know, just trying to get, answer some last minute emails. Thankfully, my email isn't going too berserk today, which is a good thing to catch up. But actually, you know, it's interesting because since the last time we've talked, which has been several years, the world has changed a little bit. And today we are going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, debt financing, what's gone on, and some of the things people should look for, and also talk about some of the misconceptions about, you know, debt financing and some deals that may not go the way people wanted them to go in general from that standpoint. Because as we were talking offline, a lot of people start off by thinking, oh, somebody pauses the distributions, and next thing you know, it's, oh, everyone just jumps to Ponzi scheme, which is, to me, I, in most instances, furthest from the truth. Now, some bad stuff does go on, but for a lot of these deals, it's a bad deal, which has happened. So love to get roll back a little bit more, talk just about debt financing in general, because I know that's something you're very passionate about, and hear some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know where you want me to start, but it's been a crazy couple of years here, 4 years. I think just to kind of recap how I got into real estate was back in 2015. I lived in the Nashville market, was in a sales role, had high commissions, lumpy commissions. I was looking for a place to park my money. And real estate just kind of made sense, right? Cash flow, tax benefits, appreciation. What I didn't realize, Chris, is like in 2015 to 2019, Nashville was experiencing a tremendous boom. And I mean, everything that I bought and flipped and burred at that time just worked out. Never had any sorts of issues beyond like, you know, you peel off a wall and you see something behind it that you're maybe not prepared for when you were doing your rehab budget. But who cares? You can throw another couple thousand dollars at it, get that problem solved, and you'll still be fine in the end. And that strategy worked until about 2022. Happy to go into kind of some of the things that I've seen, but ultimately, like, yeah, the real estate is about supply and demand. I think I understand more about like buying right these days than I did back then. And a lot of different learning lessons I've had over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I've been in real estate since, you know, before the turn of the century. So I was around for and heavily involved in, you know, the 2001 crash, 2008, and 2001 really wasn't a crash, but was some adjustments going on through there. And 2015 to 19, like you said, was really good times. And, you know, some of us, I just call myself a grumpy investor sometimes, because as 2021 and 22 started coming around, and I started seeing pricing just skyrocket, but people's incomes just wasn't, you know, it just had me thinking back that this was not sustainable. And also all the gurus out there teaching people that you can do this because it's so easy, which it was easy previously to make money in many years. But then, you know, tables have turned, and, you know, it's not that I'm sitting here telling people I told you so, but most of us, a lot of us were more cautious, which I think you also were very cautious. So you've had that experience that you understood what was going on during that time. So let's talk a little bit about that and really what you saw coming, or, you know, what you planned for, and some of the things that really people, you know, whether at that point in time or even today, just some of the lessons learned that people should be looking at as understanding real estate, especially when you start borrowing money against that real estate.
Yeah. So I'll start with this idea of income growth and rent growth, right? So we're at an interesting time right now. I don't know if this is something you track, but I still get sent deals to me all the time where it's like, hey, this is a Class B investment. It's in yada yada Southeast market that's growing hand over fist, and you can go in and really raise rents to market level. And then when you look at it from, I had one hit my desk this morning, an investor was asking me to just take a second pair of eyes on it. When you look at it, the rent to median income was at 37%. And they were saying, hey, but the market rent is this. And he was right, for a 2024 build that was kind of 2 miles down the street, that's what they were charging at there. So I totally understand that. But he was in a 1978 build, and it was as much smaller property with no pool, mail service, pet park, no amenities at all. Yeah. And so I guess what I'm trying to say with that, though, is there is a, in my opinion, an actual limit on how much people can spend on rent. And usually for me, anything over 30, I'm starting to have a yellow flag. Anything over 35% of their median income is a pretty big red flag to me. And so the idea that this guy was looking at something that it was already 37% to median income, the rent was per month, that automatically right there screams like, hey, what are you doing? There's not a ton of that room that you can go grow. In fact, you're probably going to go backwards with new supply coming online and things like that. So that's the first piece of it right there.
And what's interesting to some of the that component is, so, you know, I mentioned my real estate background, and I did a lot of underwriting for multifamily on the, you know, when I was on the development side of things. And when we were looking at new projects, and typically we were doing more new development, you know, one of the first things we would do also is we'd have John Burns Real Estate actually provide a market study for us. And, you know, it would cost you $10,000 or $20,000, but they would go through and they would look at all the absorption in that area. And just like you said, new builds were at this much and others at this much. And the other thing that I think people ignore as part of that, especially on the new build side, they may see somebody's getting, call it $2 a square foot, but they forgot to tell you that there's 3 months concessions, or what are the concessions of within there. So you're really not getting, you know, that, well, you're getting it, but you're giving the person 15 months of rent for, you know, they're only paying you for 12 months. So they're living in the building free for the first 90 days.
I'm interested to hear your perspective on this idea of supply and new supply coming into the market, because I think that was, to your point, here in Nashville, we bought an apartment complex, great part of the market in terms of sub area of the market, a lot of growth, a lot of gentrification going on in that area, MLS soccer stadium, new next door, going to build another strip mall full of restaurants and all that kind of stuff to support it. So it's a great neighborhood for younger employees, young professionals. But what we didn't take into account was exactly that, looking at the supply that was coming into that market. And we were first in that market in terms of supply, but we didn't go pull the builder's permits for what has already been approved and what had already been permitted to put sticks in the ground. So first 6 months, property is going great, not a ton of concessions. Next 12 months, rent has stabilized. We're starting to see a little bit more competition. And then 12 months to 18 months, it's like, oh my gosh, we're having to offer 2 months free rent just to get people in the door to try to compete at a lower end level of rent. So I do think supply and demand matters. And there are certain markets like Austin, Texas, which for the next decade, if you own anything in Austin, I feel like you're gonna have to slug it out pretty hard. And then there are other markets like Bentonville or Little Rock, or places like that, where maybe the supply still isn't there, where there's that demand balance more in your favor.
Yeah, I think it's going to be market by market in regards to each area. And what's going to make it even more complex is market itself is a roller coaster. And what I mean by that is because of inflation, the cost of goods and everything, you know, permits spiked and there's a lot of construction going on right now, or is it, I think it's going to be finishing up in like the next 6 to 12 months. But all the new permits and the new builds, now they may track like new permits. But for example, I work for a developer that would go get everything permitted, but they own the ground, so they didn't have any debt. So they would just sit. So when the market turned, they could start. You don't see a lot of new product or going under construction right now because the numbers don't work based on interest rates. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that, you know, nice steady uphill supply of stuff coming on. It's like we have, you know, inflection point of high product, and then we're going to go a few years with no product probably, or very little. So it's who's going to weather that storm of, can you get through getting, you know, all this new product on the market? Then over time, you know, it'll probably start to be better. And then it's probably going to go back to what it was, is you're going to see more demand because there was less supply. It's not a constant process where it's like up and down. It's like hot and cold, which really is going to provide some imbalances to certain markets. I do agree with you. I think the markets right now, I would not want to be in Austin, or, you know, honestly, probably certain places in Florida. New build is different Florida, but some of these older properties that now have go through, you know, the code permits for built, you know, the 40-year studies that they're going to have to go through. That's going to be really challenging for a lot of these developers who own these apartments or these condo projects, because, you know, when the contractors see how many buildings are more than 40 years old, and a lot of that work is like concrete restoration type work, there's only so many contractors that do that specialty. So they're just going to have basically, you know, pick their price in regards to the cost for that work, which is, it's going to be painful.
Yeah. Well, let me say one thing and then ask you a question is one, and you mentioned that about Florida. I personally, like, insurance is a huge issue, I feel like, in any coastal town. I know we were talking about kind of the Outer Banks, Wilmington area of North Carolina, but I think anything that you own near a coast that it could get hit with a hurricane, insurance is just going to become way too unaffordable unless they figure that problem out. And I don't think we're going to figure that out because of the reinsurance market. The second piece is like, I've never been on the development side, so I don't really kind of fully understand that side, but how are you thinking about like tariffs and lumber costs spiking and all that kind of stuff? Are you seeing people kind of pull forward those orders and hold them and be able to sell at a higher price? Or where do you think that conversation lands in the next 2 years?
Yeah, well, we did have, you know, the incoming administration was in office previously where they did, you know, have some types of tariffs and certain other products. You know, understanding that this administration is real estate friendly, you know, it's interesting to see how the tariffs will play out, because I think more of it is more of a shell game of getting China to the table to not tax our products that we ship as high and really use that as kind of a back and forth. I know there was talk about doing certain things with Canada, which to me, that's where I scratch my head, because again, a lot of the lumber, a lot of steel, a lot of that stuff does come from Canada. You know, trying to, you know, move that to the US is like, lumber is going to be challenging, because you look at Canada, it's freaking all trees. Sorry, anyone from Canada, but that's a main supply where, again, we have a lumber, but not to that extent. I also am curious, though, to see that it's probably not going to have as much of an impact, because I think a lot of the, call it the subcontractors and suppliers, are going to see down inventory because you're not going to see, I don't think you're going to see as much home building that we've seen or as much multifamily building. So those suppliers that were so busy, you know, their supply is going down. So they may have to make some adjustments as well to how that focus is. So I don't think they're going to be having, you know, the button on full speed in production wise because there's so much demand by the U.S. economy for new construction. I think because of the permits and everything that's been slowing down, you're going to start to see, you know, some of those companies probably start to soften. So it might not have as significant impact as people think.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess to kind of summarize that piece of the conversation, though, I think the last report I saw, United States is still short 4 million housing units, but those 4 million housing units are not dispersed equally. Austin might be oversupplied. San Francisco might be undersupplied. Like, supply and demand matters in this market. And I would encourage anybody who's involved, at least at the commercial level, to truly understand what's going in the ground in the next couple of years, where are you already from an absorption rate, and then factor those into kind of your underwriting.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll mention about supply and demand is I remember in 2005, 6, and 7, the same conversation came up about how undersupplied we were in housing. And then 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12, there was not one comment about being undersupplied in housing because you could basically pick any property you wanted. I do think we have a supply problem in regards to the amount of properties on the market for sale, but an overall housing like shortage of, oh my God, we need 4 million more homes. That's the type of data that I always question because there's families that have kids who are of age to go have a place to live. But unfortunately, they also don't have the income where they can actually go afford that. So yes, they may be counted of, okay, my two kids need a place to go live. But if they don't have the income anyways, they're not going to go there. They're still going to stay at home until they have that suitable income. And like you said, with markets and Sotheby's properties at 35, 40%, you may look at the population and say, wow, we have all these people between the age of 25 and 30 who really need a place to live. But if the rents are at 40%, they're just going to stay home. So it doesn't matter whether the housing is there or not. They're not going to be able to fill that supply.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I don't know how it pans out. I do think, you know, one of the things that I've learned a lot from hosting the show, having a podcast and kind of listening to different people on the show is we want to bucketize the real estate market into a big bucket and say, oh, it's a real estate market. When really the real estate market is a bunch of sub markets all built together. So there's office, there's multifamily, there's industrial, there's class A, B, and C, there's big cities, there's small cities. I mean, it really is market dependent.
Yeah. People want to take a, you know, and just residential real estate is basically, well, we're on the mortgage side, you know, it's $13 trillion in mortgages out there. And people try and, you know, real estate is however many trillion, people just want to take and be like, oh, real estate, where, like you said, there's so many cross segments. And I think between that and people understanding how illiquid real estate is and the fact that it moves so slow compared to everything else. And in today's world, you can see Bitcoin go from 100,000 to 90,000 to 110. And literally by the time we started this podcast, or, you know, stocks, again, the markets can fluctuate very quickly. Real estate doesn't do that anymore. You know, the data that comes out today for real estate is from closings that at best are from 90 to 120 to 150 days ago. It's so slow moving. And in today's world, with everyone having a phone, thinking everything's so instantaneous, that coupled with, you know, trying to just macro real estate, I think really puts people into sometimes pigeonholing certain aspects of it of, oh, I'm just going to do this because of X, Y, and Z, where it's like, that's not really, you know, probably a wise decision. No.
Isn't it crazy? Like I've heard that the, to your point, that real estate market that the Fed tracks is like 90 to 120 days old. I just think it's crazy that as big a market as it is and as technology advanced that the United States is, we don't have real-time dashboards around that kind of stuff. Maybe even not real-time, but at least weekly updates on that kind of data.
Yeah. Well, one thing to consider, though, is like we have a loan that is, we're the lender on that's closing today. Okay, so today we're recording, actually it's Monday. You know, it's called this mid-December. When do you think that loan went under agreement from as part of the sale when they negotiated the price.
Yeah.
It was October.
Two months ago?
It was 2 months ago. So, yeah. You know, and that's where, you know, part of it is they could get further data, but until it closes in that process takes 2 months, you know, and again, and people think, you know, they're going to shrink it with, you know, technology, a blockchain and all this stuff. No, they're not. You're not going to get a tech county to start using blockchain, let's be honest. But so that's part of the problem is, you know, a lot of the deals are negotiated like pre-election. You know, this deal is, you know, what's happened since the election? Things could have gone up or down, or a war, or whatever it is. So while data should be able to flow a little bit better, a lot of the pricing numbers really is from deals that were still negotiated several months ago.
Gotcha. Yeah. How are you looking at debt markets right now?
So as in being in the debt space is what we do and not own a lot of, you know, real estate, we're being very cautious. And we've always been, you know, for us as a lender, you know, what I mean by that is, A, we focus on non-performing loans, but we do have a small portion of our portfolio where we do some lending on the shorter term side of things. And we have really dialed up our underwriting, basically on, you know, really challenging every appraisal, understanding what's the borrower's exit strategy, where are they for loan to value, how much they bring into the table. And I can't tell you how many deals we see today that people are trying to squeeze in where they are predicting the best case scenario. They have the rosiest of rosy glasses on. And if one small thing goes wrong, which is, and again, we're more on the residential single family side where if it takes longer to build, costs another 10% more, or a rehab, or their rents aren't there, they're not going to get that DSCR loan or wherever they need to be. So we are being extremely cautious in regards to who we're working with and the experience of that individual because of that. So I'm curious.
How do you look at the LTVs then, just as a curiosity for underwriting? So, and my general assumption is like anything in the residential market, I mean, obviously market dependent, but anything like, hey, here's your LTV. What I'm seeing here in Nashville is it's the LTV of what was bought last year. So I would assume right off the gate, like 10% haircut on that is what I'm really seeing the LTV be. Is that what you guys do in your underwriting or?
Yeah, 100%. And it's market-based where typically you're right. We do a 10% cut right off the top, what it is. And we really focus a lot on the underwriting component of the value, is, you know, a lot of people would just take an appraisal and basically like, okay, yep, good. Says we got one on, I don't even know, Tuesday. Yep, appraisal $350,000, property recently renovated, We open the appraisal, start going through, looking at the pictures, and we're like, this property is not renovated. This property hasn't been updated. Now, then the comps were from like 2 miles away. So we started looking further and it's like, oh, a house on the street recently sold for 290, you know, not 350. And, you know, it was a little bit smaller, but okay. You know, we're looking at this thing and we're like, it's pushing 300 is what they are. And the guy bought it in 2017 for like 140 grand. And he's trying to, he wants to buy like an adjacent property. So he basically wants to just use this as leverage because he wants to buy some land. And even like looking at that value, it's like, what are you going to do with the land? You know, you don't have the funds to build anything on it right now. So to us, it's like, even if we cross collateralized, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. So yeah, we really focus a lot on the underwriting of taking what's given to us with a grain of salt and looking at it and we're projecting out where we think. And I'd rather be conservative than aggressive, meaning, hey, if things stayed flat, great, because I estimated a 10% drop. If it goes 10%, we're still good. Even if it went 15, we're still good because we're not going to go LTVs typically on stuff right now above 70, maybe 75. You know, depending on the deal and kind of the spread on the price, but the lower price stuff at, you know, 1 to 300,000, you know, we're at 70% LTV max. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think that what I kind of heard from that too, is in the commercial space, a lot of sponsors are out there pitching cap rate suppression essentially. Yep. And what that means is I'm buying this for a 6 and we're going to resell this thing at a 5 cap. Well, why do you think that? And I've really started questioning a lot of assumptions like that. Oh, the dot plot says that interest rates will go down. And I hear all sorts of reasons around that kind of stuff. But ultimately, I think what I'm hearing you say is people are giving you the LTV of what it used to be. It's not wrong. It probably was 350, but it's not 350 today. And you're pulling up 2 week old data that says 290 is the street down the street. That's what I'm trying to do right now in our commercial space is when I see somebody that's, you know, trying to pitch a deal that's cap rate suppression. Okay, well, give me the opposite. What if it goes up 100 bips? What does that look like on exit?
Yeah, and that's a great point that we can dive into some of that commercial stuff as, again, that's a world I played in. And one of the things that where we always focused on was controlling what you can control. You can't control cap rate suppression. You can't control the Fed. You know, they dropped it by a quarter point yesterday, I think, or whatever it was. And the 10-year treasury, I think, shot up again. A lot of people now they're saying only two cuts maybe next year, and inflation's rearing its ugly head, which is probably going to keep the 10-year higher, which is going to keep rates higher. And that's where the commercial side is really in a bind, because a lot of the deals, I mean, they don't pencil, because if you're buying something at a six cap, but you're borrowing at seven, well, you're negative arbitrage. And how are you going to make that work? And the only person who might actually look at acquiring that or your exit might be somebody on a 1031 who wants to really hold that property for a very long time that thinks it has some significant upside to it in an area like you mentioned, Nashville, where they might be putting a stadium or some of these other deals. And you know, I am always a big fan of if you can hold real estate for perpetuity, you're always going to win. But you also got to understand the debt side of things. And the debt is what controls how long you can hold it for a lot of times, because when that note gets called due and you have to refinance it and you don't have the coverage that you need, where is that cash coming from? Which is, I think, a lot of things. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are, is what's been happening over the last 12 to 24 months with people.
Yeah, I think kind of a learning lesson I've seen over the past 4 years, 5 years is I've always known this, but I never really kind of understood it. And so this is one of those, you hear something, you understand it from an intellectual level, but until you see it in practice, maybe it doesn't make a ton of sense. And really that is you shouldn't finance long-term projects with short-term debt. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of people. So floating rate interest rate is pretty common in commercial deals. In fact, it's pretty common across all lending from what I've seen. And HELOCs and credit card notes are even floating and different things like that, right? So if your goal is to go in and buy this property and hold it for 10, 15, 20 years or whatever that is, you probably shouldn't buy that on an interest rate only that's a 3-1-1 on floating rate debt. However, if you are going to go in and it's 60% occupied, it needs a ton of rehab work, you're going to go in and do all that work for 18 months or 2 years, however long it takes you, that might make sense to go ahead and put it on a shorter term note. But I think marrying your debt with what the long-term business plan is or the short-term business plan is a key thing that investors need to think about when they're starting to underwrite their deals. Not only does this make sense from a market, supply and demand, rent growth, expenses, I can improve the NOI standpoint, but also does the debt match what how long it's going to take me and what my ultimate end goals are with this property?
Yeah. And I think that ties into also, you know, as you mentioned, the equity and kind of, again, a lot of people, I'm just going to jump back to the residential side of things. Like if I was going to go buy a property that I knew I was going to live in that city for 3 years, now I'd probably put it on a 5-year ARM and, you know, give myself an extra 2 years, but this is not my forever home. I'm probably going to be here. So, you know, I'm going to take advantage of, you know, a half a point or a 1 point discount, 5-year ARM, knowing that, but I'll take my property that I live in. We built this property, you know, when our kids were young, we know we've been here 10 plus years, and we're probably going to be here for at least another 10 years. You know, when we did that, we secured, you know, long-term financing just because you can set it and forget it. You don't have to worry about it. And then when you do that, if interest rates go down, then you can still take advantage of it and refinance that debt out like you can on a commercial deal. But yeah, I think that was a problem that a lot of people played into, was they put that short-term debt on properties that even if they were looking to bring it back up to its 60% occupancy or do a lot of work on it, I think they also overestimated how quickly they could get those units turned and get people in the door. You know, it's kind of like going out to dinner and ordering everything on the meal and think your eyes are much bigger than your stomach. And I think that happens with a lot of real estate developers that fall in love with certain projects or see an opportunity thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to get a crew that has five different crews, and we're going to be able to turn these units in 2 weeks. And then you realize, oh, it's built in 72, so it's got lead paint, it's got asbestos, and all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to, like, once you figure out the supply and demand and is the business plan feasible and matching up the debt, it's really like, what type of investor are you as well?
Yeah.
So I had this conversation with an investor the other day, and I'm like, the longer I am in this business, the more I'm like, there's nothing wrong with amortizing debt. There's nothing wrong with kind of paying that down over time. A lot of people love these interest only loans because you can cash flow more and you can distribute more. And over the long term, I think both of us agree that property values tend to go up over the long term, 20, 50 years. I can't tell you how long, but it will go up over the long term. However, any dollar that you spend amortizing a debt will come back to you at some point, either on sale price or just owning the property full out. And that's where my mind has shifted a little bit as well. And what I do in my personal portfolio, what we do on the commercial side, is like, amortizing debt is not necessarily a bad thing, because that dollar, it will come back to you. It's just locked in a different vehicle today.
Yeah. And also, it really depends on where you're at in life. As I'm at a point in my life where I prefer amortize because I'm paying something down. So it means I have less risk. You know, even if the markets do adjust in some way, for example, we bought a piece of property 10 years ago that we put it on a 15-year note. And people are like, oh, you're crazy. You're going to ruin your cash flow and everything. I'm like, it's not about the cash flow for me. We bought it because my son was 3 at the time. And when you're 18 years old, where do you go? Kids may go to college. And we're basically like, we're just going to have this thing paid off and it's going to appreciate, which it has over time. And it's doubled in value. And now, is one area of, we literally spent technically nothing on it because we did the Burr strategy where we bought it for like $100,000 cash, put 25 into it, refinance it out, got all of our money back. And now our loan has like $50,000 left on it. And the property's worth pretty much double what we've had into it. So, it's another strategy of, looking at different aspects of things. One thing you mentioned, I just want to kind of touch upon too, is when you mentioned like the investor, also understand the type of investor you are, because do you want to be in a multifamily deal for 5 to 7 years or a type of deal for that period of time? Do you want something that has an equity, a growth play that might have a little bit more risk, which I think we've seen in, certain asset classes, or do you want something that's like an income play? We run a fund that is straight income play. We tell people, look, if you're thinking that there's going to be this huge upside at the end, we want to be the boring investment is what we try and target. And, there's different people, who want different types of investments. When you're younger, you might take a little more risk. As you get older, you might take a little less. And people need to figure that out. And that's something that I've learned a lot about over the last 5 years since we started doing our funds.
Yeah. But so this may be controversial since we're both in real estate, but if you're the type of investor that wants that big appreciation and I don't really care about the cash flow, I just want to kind of accelerate my wealth journey quickly, real estate's not the best place to do that unless you're on the development side. Now, if you're on the development side, that's where you can absolutely triple 5X your money. I've never been on that side, but I believe if that's the risk that I want to take, if that's the kind of returns that I'm targeting, I still believe I'm going to go do that in a different vehicle, not through real estate. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I also would say you want to diversify, but if I was to look at, again, I'd either go development, which is where you can get that upside, but it also risk. I mean, most people though, I'd go VC, go venture, go behind a cap. I'll give you an example. I invested in a company called Miso Robotics, which is, they make the machines that flip burgers for you, which I think, so they had an early startup round that, I threw a few $1,000 in, not a ton of money, but invested in them because I'm like, oh, here's a startup that, maybe could get some upside or maybe get sold or, whatever case. I'll share a story of, so I have somebody I went to college with who went, he year or two older than me, civil engineer like me. When he graduated, he went to go work for one construction company. I went to go work for another. After about 15 years, he got out and went to go work for a software company, one that's been in news a lot because of their chips for AI have been blowing up. And this company now was, basically one of the largest companies. He'd been there for 10 years and had all these options, had everything else and so forth. And he just retired. And because that was an investment of a software company that he was a part of, but he also was buying into the company during that time. And, you know, he has made money that, you know, to me, if I had that much money, I would never have to worry about anything again in my life. And, yep. You know, the way this person's lifestyle is, I think they're very similar where, you know, so, and that's software. And I look back and all the computer science majors who, you know, got all these stock options and stuff, and they've done very, very well on the tech side over the last 10 or 15 years. So yeah, real estate is looks cool and sexy, but if you mm-hmm. want the big returns, it's more an ego trip than anything that is for returns personally.
Yeah. And I think there's where I've spent a long time in technology, and the equity you get in technology will outpace any of your earnings that you get if you can pick and choose the right ones. Now, of course, a lot of VCs go under, and if you're into VC investing, it's about, hey, I really need two out of 10 investments to do well, and I'm just throwing away the other eight. But if you think about like your career that way as well, it could be an interesting play to say, I'm going to make my wealth generation by picking the right startup, the right ecosystem to buy into early. And early can be 2,000 employees, 5,000 employees. I mean, let's not forget in 2015, Facebook only had 10,000 employees and now they have over 100,000. But like picking that as your career and then finding something that's more stable income, like what you guys do, or more, I just want to park capital inside of real estate that's tax efficient and will naturally appreciate and generate some cash flow over time like we do. I mean, that's another way you could kind of look at your career and your investments.
Yeah, and know what you want to do, because I'll share briefly two quick stories that, so when I was when I worked for a GC and I was managing construction, there was one deal, this was in 2000 and I want to say 4, 5, 6 timeframe, where a gentleman sold a tech company, sold it for like $20 million. Is like, I'm going to go develop a real estate project, and did a co-GP, put basically all his $20 million into this high-end condo project. And it didn't get finished till 2007. And you can imagine what happened with it. He got wiped, essentially. Now, another one I'll share was, and this is kind of where the development side can turn you into a tech company in the sense, there was this large parcel of land in Boston that nobody for 20 years could figure out what to do with it. Developer who did like small movie theaters basically bought this property and another property for $5 million both from next to Fenway Park, which if you're familiar with Boston, that's where the Red Sox play, which there's a lot of foot traffic. They bought this 1 million-plus square foot Sears warehouse building that nobody could figure out what to do with it. And this was in the late 90s. They turned it into a mixed use property. Blue Cross Blue Shield moved into the building, and basically, you know, their headquarters, which if you get a tenant like that, that's very, very good. They essentially ended up selling the building and then buying a portion of the Boston Celtics. So, you know, you can imagine how well that must have done for them in that scheme of things. So you went from being a lonely old developer to, you know, buying a property to then being a minority owner in the Boston Celtics. You know,
which, pretty good turnout.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well for them in that standpoint. But there are cases where, again, real estate can look like a VC, but those are, and again, I share that story, but that's a 1 in a 1 billion. No, that's a 1 in a 1 million thing that happens. And if I probably interviewed them today, they're like, we got lucky and the market just everything aligned perfectly.
Yeah, I think that's so few and far between. Like, even if we look at the current president or future president Trump, I mean, you're looking at two generations of wealth building to get to that stage, right? It was obviously his father and then him. So, I mean, it's two generations to get to that kind of level. Whereas, you know, Zuck did it in 10 years by building the right application software.
Yeah. And look how many times that future president has failed, you know, in Atlantic City. I mean, there's numerous bankruptcies that have existed. And I think one of the things that we can roll into as we, you know, kind of finish off the last leg of this episode is, you know, in real estate, you know, deals go bad. And it's part of the deal, you know, what we see, and we see it, and any deal, any fund, anything could go wrong for a myriad of issues. But just because it goes wrong doesn't mean you need to start waving the flag of scam, Ponzi, fraud, whatever. And to me, and I'm curious to get your opinion on this, I see A lot of people now, that's the initial reaction they go to is, oh, pause distributions, like, oh, fraud. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we were talking on this a little bit before. I've had a lot of conversations with different folks. I mean, there is fraud out there for sure. Mm-hmm. Then there are bad operators and bad operations for sure. And mm-hmm. then there is, nope, this just did not work out for one reason or another. I mean, when the Fed increases rates by 500 bips over 18 months, like that does a lot to your floating rate debt and gets very mm-hmm. wonky on your cap rate exit assumptions and things like that. Is mm-hmm. that really something that the operator should have foreseen? My statement on that is no. Like, we don't all have crystal balls out here that we're looking into that retail investors and other investors don't get a chance to look into. We're making educated assumptions based off of what we've seen happen in the past, and we're projecting a little bit of what we think is going in the future. We're picking one or two to three areas of risk where we think are most probable to happen and modeling those out. And then we're moving forward with a yes or no from there. When something happens that's never been done in history, we can't really model that out. So I think you're right with the pausing of the distributions. I mean, sometimes that's a good thing if you're an investor to hear, because that means somebody's thinking about what's going to happen 12, 18, 24 months from now. I have seen people in this space, though, say, we aren't going to pause distributions. We're going to keep them sending out. And that doesn't necessarily mean your deal's in a good spot. I mean, one story that I was close to and I heard about, we were not a part of it, but essentially the operator kept sending distributions out. And then during their monthly report, they said, hey, we're going to have to come up with something like $7 to $8 million in the next 15 days or this property is going to get foreclosed on. So imagine getting that as an investor, right? Like to me, that says the operator didn't want to have the difficult conversation and thought it would be easier just to keep everybody happy by sending out distributions. And now they're mm-hmm. in a worse spot because of it.
Yeah. And that, wow, that's mind blowing. Yes. You know, issue distributions and also need a $7 million check. But yeah, and it really, and one of the questions that people will get posed is, okay, distributions are paused, then there's a capital call. And in that instance, capital calls can still be a good thing. They can be a good thing. They could be a bad thing. And it really is dependent on the sponsor, and this goes, I think, back to good sponsor versus inexperienced sponsors. How are they underwriting it for the time being? Are they doing a capital call that's going to get them over the hurdle? Or are they doing a capital call that is going to get them to, okay, I bought ourselves another 18 months and let's, you know, pray that interest rates come down at that point in time. What is that plan? And that's the most important thing you need to understand as an investor is what goes on in that time. And again, if you do the capital call and the deal goes bad because they were hoping for something, it still doesn't mean it was any type of fraudulent or bad actor. It just means, hey, look, this is what they're betting on and or what their plan is. And if the plan doesn't come to fruition, then that's unfortunate.
Yeah. And so on the receiving end of a capital call and mm-hmm. the capital call email kind of went like the communication went like this. We need $4,000 or $4 million. $1.5 million is going to pay for the interest rate for the next 2 years. So it's going to put a, it's going to keep our interest rate in check for the next 2 years. So we're betting on interest rate environment improving mm-hmm. in the next 2 years. Also, $2 million of it is going to pay down the loan to get us in a better equity position overall that will produce mm-hmm. cash flow enough to prepare us that if in 2 years from now, we have to do another interest rate extension, we will have the bank cash in the bank to do that. Like to me, that kind of just made sense.
That's a good plan. That would be something like, okay, they've outlined kind of what this is for and kind of how they're getting there. And hopefully they can fulfill that obligation. And that's where you're counting on them and their experience to do what they say they're going to do.
Yep. And the last part of that communication was, or we could sell the property today and we could return 70% of your money back. So, mm-hmm. and they gave it to us as investors to vote on it. I participated in the capital call. I voted on the capital call to go down that route because mm-hmm. I do believe over the next, like if you are in a period right now where if you can last the next 2 to 3 years, you're probably going to end up in a more favorable position than you are today, at least mm-hmm. at some point during that 3 years. Whereas mm-hmm. if you just sell today, you're just automatically receiving a 30% loss, which by the way, a 30% loss It goes back to all investing has risk. There's no sure thing. You need to, when you're an LP, assume that if you do 10 deals, one of them will lose money, right? So do not be putting all of your eggs in one basket and hoping that that's not the deal that has the issue.
Oh, 100%. Now, out of curiosity, the deal that had the capital call, what class property was that? What type of
A class?
Okay. I asked that question because I think that is a major component that I think people should also understand. If it's a class C property and they're doing a capital call, I would most likely right off the bat probably say no, unless of there is some really strong reason. Class A, and again, it goes back to, you know, the three caveats of real estate: location, location, location. Class A will make its way back. Time is your friend. You know, a lot of these class C projects that we're seeing, they were getting there because of value add and rent growth. And the reality is they're never going to get the value add or for the cost that they wanted to for the construction numbers. And then the rent growth isn't probably going to be there, which is what you've seen in some of these deals by that company in Houston that went under, had Apple something in their name. You know, there's some other co-GPs out there who were specifically targeting class C properties and really just focused on churning and burning those quick. And those are where you're probably going to see a lot more struggle. So understanding class property, I think, is very important as well.
Well, and that kind of brings me to kind of the last little lesson I've learned over the past 5 years is I do believe in the reversion to the mean in real estate. In the stock market, I could make a suggestion that we've printed so much money that that's why you're seeing PE ratios get out of whack right now. And specifically, if you take out the Mag 7, then the PE ratios are above average, but they're not as egregious as it kind of looks on paper. Where in real estate, everything trades based, in my opinion, based off of a spread of the 10-year. And class A properties, multifamily, that's usually about 150 to 200 bips. So if you are buying properties that are right at the 10-year, just know that you're going to experience some cap rate expansion. What I saw going into 2019, 2020 is that class C properties were starting to suppress below their median. And then 2021, I mean, gosh, you were seeing class C trade at like five caps when in reality, like class A's, in my opinion, should be 4 to 5 cap, but depending on the kind of market and the location. And in my opinion, class C should trade at like an 8 to 10 cap.
I was going to say 8 to 10 is my,
Yeah. So when you buy at a 5 and in the reversion back to the mean is 10, you've just basically cut the value of that property in half. You already have to assume that's going to happen. Now, I don't know what your view is on that, but like I look at commercial real estate today and say, what is the 10-year trading at? What is the typical spread? Where are we in that typical spread? And then kind of make an assumption based off of that.
Exactly. What's your level of tolerance of risk? Because if I can get free money from the government at 4.5%, I love real estate, but you know, class A, yeah, I would pay, you know, like you said, 1 to 2 points spread there. If class C is only a 1 to 2 above or that area, or it's come down, compressed considerably, it's going to revert back to the mean because, you know, I think, and what causes that with real estate is especially it's a cash flowing based business, especially commercial, is granted a lot of the bigger companies have tons of cash, but the people who live in these properties, you know, all that money that gets printed, where does it end up? Let's be honest.
Company's balance sheet.
Yeah, it ends up the company's balance sheet. It may start with you as an individual where, okay, I got a check for $2,000 from the government or $3,000, but you know, most people don't save it. And that's evident by savings during COVID was skyrocketing. Now it's completely gone. And now credit card debts are at all-time highs. So that money eventually flows back to the top. So back to what we started with this initial conversation of, you know, when you start seeing rents at, you know, 35, 40% of the income, it's just not there. And then you got to drop the rents, which drops the revenue, which drops your NOI, which drops your cap rate. And, you know, and then all of a sudden the cap rates go up. It's that perfect storm of value that, you know, is going to cause a lot of heartache. And as you mentioned it during this interview as well, that, you know, people also had that short-term debt. You tie that onto it and they're basically, you know, I saw a picture that last night that was a meme. It was a little boy who's probably, you know, 3 years old and he's, you know, basically, you know, 3 feet tall, you know, in a men's bathroom with his pants down, standing up to a urinal that's like this tall. And to me, it's like, you know, you could call that commercial real estate of where they're, you know, the hurdle to get to, you know, overcome the debt piece of it and where they're at right now for NOI. It's like, it's such a huge hurdle. It's impossible to overcome.
And I think that's why you see some of the, I forgot the firm's name down in Houston, but a couple of these firms are going under because it's like, we already project that we cannot, we'll never be able to realistically meet that. It's better for the bank to retake these properties and foreclose on them. And that's where you're starting to see some of that. I don't know if we'll ever get there where it'll be like a 2008 where you'll see that across the board or anything like that. Again, we had this conversation, I think, on my show, but the banks realize that they don't want to be operators of properties. They would rather pretend and extend and then keep that going. Because when they foreclose on a property, now they have to mark to market their entire book. And that's not a process that they don't want to go through either.
Yeah. And I think the big thing with 2008, you got to remember on the residential side, it was just so written with fraud. There's so much fraud going on and people getting 100%+ loans, which that doesn't happen to the extent that it happened then. Commercial will still take a beating, I think, for the next few years, but there's still opportunity as well. There are going to be out there for people to either come in as an equity piece to kind of come in or buy assets that are in distress. So one thing I just, as we wrap up the show, I just want to remind people is just because real estate has gotten a lot harder to find assets, there's still plenty of ample opportunity out there within the marketplace that you can find.
Well, $13 trillion just on the residential space signifies that no matter what market you're in or where you live, somebody is making money in that space when the market is that big.
So as we wrap up, Matt, I'm not going to ask you what your favorite ice cream is, which I love about your show. But, you know, over the last 5 years, is there whether a book, video, a movie or anything or a friend or something that somebody's said or you've seen that has had a huge impact on your life, whether it's from a personal or professional standpoint?
I mean, a couple things I would say there is one, my favorite book is The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch. I keep it on my desk. Go check out the video on YouTube of him giving the speech if you're not much of a reader, The Last Lecture on YouTube.
I don't know that one. That's a good one.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the genesis of it behind after this. But there's a guy on Twitter called Alexi. He and I have become decent friends over the past couple of years. And he's out there educating LP investors. And he's really helped me kind of understand some of the sensitivity analysis and the spreads on the treasury and different things like that. Go give him a good Twitter follow because he's worth the follow there.
Yeah. His last name is C-H-E. And then it is ends in a ski, I think. So
yeah, but his stuff is pretty good, though.
Oh, it's really good. No, I follow him all the time on. Yeah. On X and on other wherever. I've subscribed to his newsletter and everything. Yeah. LinkedIn is big as well.
Yeah. And then the last thing I say is I got married this year. As part of that, I became a bonus dad to two little ones. And I joined this community called Front Row Dads, where it's family men with businesses, not businessmen with families. And that's been it's been really impactful for me because I think you have kids, we have kids. Like it's you all go through the same stuff no matter how successful you are with your kids. And it's always good to have a sounding board there. So to have some other men that care about being good fathers as well, it's the number thing. One thing we can do as a man is give back to the future men of our country because they're going to be the future leaders. So yeah, it's been a impactful community for me.
That's awesome. So as we wrap up this episode, just how can people reach out to you?
Yeah, sure. So you can follow me on Ice Cream with Investors, the podcast Ice Cream with Investors on all your favorite podcasting apps. Or you can just go check us out, nextlevelincome.com. There's a button in the top right corner that says schedule a call or invest with us. And that'll link to my calendar and you can find time with me there. If I can help anybody, no matter if you're just getting started or truly advanced in your journey, somebody helped me along my way and it's my duty to give back to others. So if I can help you, happy to do so.
Great. Well, Matt, thanks for joining us on this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. Hope everyone, as when they listen to this, will be past the new year and holiday season, but hope all those times were great. And for those with families, hope you had precious time to spend with them as well during this time of year. So thank you all for listening and we'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.